Today's guest is Dr. David Albala. He is a distinguished urologist, graduated with a geology degree from Lafayette College and earned his MD from Michigan State University. He completed his surgical residency at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center and an andrology fellowship at Washington University under Ralph V. Clayman. At Loyola University, he rose to professor in urology and radiology. He later became a tenured professor at Duke University, where he co-directed the andrology fellowship and directed the Center for Minimally Invasive and Robotic Urological Surgery. Currently, he is Chief of Urology at Krauss Hospital and Medical Director for Associated Medical Professionals. He has authored numerous publications and textbooks and has been a visiting professor worldwide. We welcome Dr. Albala to the podcast.
Welcome. My name is Dr. David Albala from Syracuse, New York, and it's a pleasure to be with you today to share the best of SIU Issue 3. Today, we're going to look at three different papers that have been published and talk about urology clinics, urology-based clinical practice guidelines in an international setting. We'll also talk about urinary tract obstruction secondary to fungus balls and go over a nice review, and then talk about a rare complete duplication of the urinary tract with dual neurogenic bladders necessitating intermittent catheterizations from both hemibladders. So our first paper is the use of urology-based clinical practice guidelines in an international setting. This is a paper that was published. Authors from the United States, Senegal, Colombia, and the United Kingdom looked at clinical practice guidelines and how we can implement them in our standard medical practices. The uptake of clinical practice guidelines has not been really measured or studied in the urology setting, and they may be a valuable tool to low and middle income countries. And the objective of this paper was to look at the role of stakeholders in clinical practice guidelines in the context of an international urology practice. The hope was to identify barriers to uptake of these guidelines and evaluate the role that stakeholders play in the developmental process. So in this study, a 17-question survey was developed. It was essentially developed in English, Spanish, French, and Chinese, and it was given to urologists in an international clinical setting. The goal was to understand demographic variables, sort of the knowledge of daily practices, and how relevant these guidelines were to practicing urologists. Barriers to the uptake of these guidelines were investigated, along with provider perspectives on key stakeholders, trying to understand how we can develop these guidelines going forward. And the study was classified as a minimal risk, and it did receive exempt IRB status from the University of California, San Francisco. So there are almost 250 participants from 28 countries. You can see 20 participants were from Africa, Latin America, the United States, Asia, all across the United States. Men made up the most number of physicians that were involved. 92% of this patient, the physicians were men. 70% of these were trained in their home country. The breakdown between academic physicians, which was 35% versus 65% in private practice. And you can see looking here that physicians 1 to 5 years out made up a third of the population, and physicians that have been in practice for over 16 years made up a third of the physicians that were accounted in the study. So the first thing that these authors looked at was the urology decision-making factors for clinical practice guidelines access. And over 40% of them relied heavily on clinical practice guidelines. 25% prioritized scientific publications, and 20% valued their personal expertise and habits. Expert opinions and medical training also accounted for a smaller percentage of the clinical practice guidelines and what physicians would follow to try to practice. The Decision-making process was used primarily from meta-analysis and clinical trials. You can see that case reports and case series made up a very insignificant number of resources for decision-making. And this seems to make sense that a meta-analysis looking at larger volumes of patients and how these patients turned out in developing guidelines makes much more sense. The access to clinical practice guidelines, you can see 70% of it was done at home. The mobile applications was over 70%, and in the hospital, about 60% of clinical practice guidelines were accessed in this situation. You can see that there were some access challenges depending on the institution where physicians practiced, as also with personal membership across the board. And the open access was perceived to be a significant burden to allow clinicians to use these. Almost 40% of clinicians perceived limited access and open access as being somewhat limited across the board. So when you look at the utilization in daily practice, the majority of patients, over 90% of physicians, used these clinical practice guidelines. You can see the usage by the region varied, but it was very high in Africa, in Latin America, and in China. And the most used guidelines were the European Urology Association guidelines and the American Urological Association guidelines. You can see that on this table, the different countries that were using what the ministries of health contributions were, but clearly the American Urological Association and the European Association guidelines were the ones that were followed mostly. The SIU guidelines were followed sometimes 70% of the time, but you can see the local guidelines were used sometimes and never by almost 60% of them. Here you can see the key stakeholders in the local clinical practice guidelines were scientific associations, national urology boards, ministries of health, and then you can see to a much lower extent, insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies across the board. So, what were the main barriers for clinical practice use guidelines being adapted? Well, obviously, the lack of adaptability played a significant role. So, what was developed in the United States or in Europe was very difficult to translate in about 30% of the guidelines into foreign countries such as Africa and Latin America. Other factors include cost, expertise, and equipment limitations across the board. Here you can see what the relative value of each association, the American Urological Association, the European Association, and the SIU. You can see clearly the EAU, when you look at the frequency and always use of these guidelines, the EAU represented about 63% usage versus 54% of usage with the American Urological Association, and then about a 43% usage in the SIU. Local institutions obviously play a less significant role, and the National Urology Association plays an even lesser role than the EAU or the AUA or the SIU guidelines. So there's no question that clinical practice guidelines are being used around the world in national hospitals or in academic centers. The American Urological Association and the EAU really are responsible for producing the bulk of these clinical practice guidelines. The lack of adaptability is relevant, and it's difficult to translate in some cases guidelines that are established in the United States and in Europe into other countries such as Africa and Latin America. Clearly, this lack of applicability and acceptability in different countries exists partly because of cultural reasons. The development of these practice guidelines is costly, time-consuming, and it's a laborious activity to put these together. And this adaption across countries really is hindered by this gap in research knowledge. And I think going forward, what this study showed is it's essential to assess resources in other countries when developing clinical practice guidelines. So in other words, the American Urological Association and the EAU has to look at, cultures in Africa, China, Latin America to try to help develop these guidelines. So there's no question that these guidelines are used by urologists around the world. There may be some lack of applicability in the daily global urology practice, but creating and adapting guidelines suited to regional contexts is essential for developing and implementing clinical practice guidelines that are associated with local socioeconomic and epidemiological factors. Our second paper is a very interesting paper looking at urinary tract obstruction secondary to fungus balls. And this is a systematic review that came out of Australia. And essentially, we know that the incidence of fungal urinary tract infections is increasing, especially in the immunocompromised patients and those patients that have indwelling catheters. The formation of fungal balls causing ureteral and renal obstruction has emerged as a significant urological challenge. We know that the Candida species and Aspergillus and other fungi are most responsible for these development of fungal balls. And these fungal balls can lead to hydronephrosis, obstruction, renal damage, and sepsis. Interesting, these patients present with nonspecific symptoms overlapping with bacterial urinary tract infections. And the goal of this paper was to develop approaches to identifying these patients, recommending treatment with systemic antifungal drainage procedures, and possible surgical intervention. So really, the goal was to try to understand how common these types of infections are, and then enhance the recommendation, the recognition, and the management of fungal balls going forward. So using Medline, PubMed, eBase databases, searching the databases through December of 2023, articles that had patients diagnosed with fungal balls with urinary tract obstruction were included in the study. So there had to be demographic information, information on the clinical presentation, as well as the treatment to be included into the study. Case reports and observational studies were also included in the study, but studies that had commentaries or editorials or abstracts were not included, and patients that were under 18 were not included in the study. So the data was synthesized quantitatively and qualitatively, and the risk of bias was evaluated using the Oxford evidence-based medicine level of evidence. And here you can see 197 studies were eligible looking at these databases. 144 were excluded because they didn't meet the eligibility criteria. 53 studies were included that looked at 56 patients that had fungal balls with ureteral obstruction and renal obstruction. The mean age was 55 years of age, and you can see 60% or two-thirds of patients were males, and one-third of patients were females. These patients initially presented with flank pain, fever, and hematuria. Those were the common presenting complaints. But what's more interesting is over 75% of these patients were immunocompromised due to a pre-existing condition or a medication. And clearly, diabetes was the major reason for immunosuppression and immunocompromising in these patients. All these patients were diagnosed for yeast in cultures, and they did have the presence of obstruction on renal imaging. Ultrasound and CT were the most commonly used agents for identifying the obstruction, but clearly MRI and intravenous pyelography was also used. 47 patients out of the 56 were diagnosed with acute kidney injury, and 35% of patients had a leukocytosis. And the most common species identified were Candida species as well as Aspergillus. And this diagram here shows how, starting from 197 studies here, you can see that we whittle it down to 53 studies that encompassed 56 patients. Antifungal treatment obviously was the mainstay in patients in over 90% of patients, and these agents included amphotericin in about 45% of patients, as well as fluconazole, to try to treat these patients. There was a combination of different routes to identify these patients with oral, intravenous, or locally introduced agents into the bladder, for example. The interventions for the obstruction included nephrostomy tube placement in almost 50% of patients, as well as stent placement in 46% of patients. And in 16% of patients, both stents and percutaneous nephrostomy tubes were used. You can see that there were a significant number of patients that responded both to the combination of antifungal as well as surgical intervention, almost 90% of patients. But I think this other finding is significant. 12.5% of patients died despite of intervention. And the mortality, when we looked at this in depth, was primarily due to pulmonary embolism, circulatory failure, small bowel infarction, or pneumonia. So I think this study highlights the rising prevalence of urinary tract infections, especially we're starting to see resistant strains. The potential for fungal balls to complicate the clinical course is becoming more and more evident. In this study, you can see that the age of patients range from 26 to 82 years, with a mean of about 55, and these patients presented with nonspecific symptomatology, such as flank pain, fevers. Hematuria occurred, which can be overlapping with a bacterial urinary tract infection, but the overriding majority of these patients were immunocompromised, primarily due to diabetes, and this was found in over 75% of the patients. Preoperative imaging is often misleading and can mimic other reasons for renal obstruction. A urine culture that demonstrated funguria is clinically crucial in making the diagnosis in these patients. And there is sort of a lack of uniform guidelines on what the dosing, what the administration form should be, and how we should monitor these patients. And I think this study brings out that what's important first is less invasive interventions are first-line solutions, and more aggressive measures should be used in patients that are refractory or severe cases. And given that case reports and case series were used in deriving some of the data from patients for this study, there is a bias and there is a low level of evidence from this study. So I think the takeaway messages for me in this study were this review highlights the need for being vigilant for suspecting fungal balls, especially in patients that are immunocompromised. Diabetics, this should come to the top of one's clinical acumen. And when we see patients with urinary tract infections, understanding that they can develop fungal ball and develop obstruction. The treatment process is multifaceted and requires antifungal therapy in the majority of cases, as well as interventions for drainage. And the early use of antifungals and decompression of the urinary system is really key in optimizing the success in treatment of these patients. And here you can see is just a small algorithm. The patients that come in that have ureteric obstruction with no obvious fungal ball, if they're septic, you can see you go to the left side of the diagram. You need to resuscitate these patients, achieve decompression, and if there's no improvement, ensure that you get urine cultures. And if you do have fungal cultures, if the fungal cultures come back positive, those patients need to be treated with antifungal medication. If the patients are obstructed, decompression is critical, identifying the fungal organism, and then decompressing either with a percutaneous nephrostomy tube or a stent will lead to good outcomes in these patients. And our third paper today is looking at a rare complete duplication of the entire urinary tract with dual neurogenic bladders that require dual intermittent catheterization. And this is a case that came from India. This is an 18-year-old male that presented with two renal pelvises, two ureters. The patient had a lipomeningeal myelocele. He had some anal rectal malformations, a rectal vesicle fistula, and he presented with bladder stones in his right hemibladder. Video urodynamics were done in this patient, which showed a poorly compliant bladder, altered bladder morphology. There was gross vesicoureteral reflux and acontractility with large postvoid residuals. And this condition, when one looks at it, would require a significant surgical intervention to try to split the urethral plate, the urogenital sinus, both ureteric buds. And the question, would a patient be able to survive with this, was raised. And there's no reports, at least in the literature, that this congenital defect occurred in one individual. And this is hence the first report of dual intermittent catheterization to empty two lower urinary tracts. And what's interesting in this is the patient presented with urinary incontinence. He was treated with Vesicare 5 milligrams, and he underwent clean intermittent catheterization. You can see the serum creatinine was 1.45. The patient had severe hydronephrosis, and then with this dual catheterization, the creatinine came down. And it just, I think, speaks to the rarity of an embryological origin. So here you can see this is just a shows an MRI image of a complete urinary tract duplication. You can see that there are two renal pelvises, two ureters, a right and upper ureter, and a left lower ureter. On the contralateral side, you can see it. These drain into two right hemibladders. I mean, hemibladders, one on the right, one on the left, and there's two urethras that drain out. And I think that what's interesting is you can see when contrast is injected, you do get bilateral reflux into the lower moieties on this urethrocystogram. And then what you have is here you see that with intermittent catheterization, you can drain these systems effectively, lower the creatinine in this patient. And here, this is an Effman type 3 complete duplication, a very significantly rare complication. And this is the first reported case in a single individual that I'm aware of. So, an interesting case study showing the real power of intermittent catheterization, as this patient is really not a candidate for any type of surgical intervention. So, an interesting case report that came from India, from our colleagues in India. So that's our discussion today. I just want to thank you for listening to the best of the SIU, and we look forward to our next edition coming up very shortly. Thank you very much.